look at the science behind some popular aging claims in our regular science news segment with Gemma Tarlag. She also has some fun facts to share about carnivorous plants and how ancient footprints can tell us a lot about our ancestors.
Gemma Tarlag is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you again.
So, good news, our lifespans tend to be increasing. Bad news, we don't always know how to age healthfully and well, and that's one of the issues you focus on in this month's edition of Discover Magazine. You take a look at a lot of popular claims about aging. First, give us a broad strokes. What's the current state of the art when it comes to getting older?
Well, when it comes to getting older, not only are we all doing it, but we're all doing it just proportionately at a higher rate than ever. We've got 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every day. So a lot of us are getting up there in years, and as you can imagine, just about all of us are eager to make sure that, you know, that part of our life is just as vigorous and rewarding as the rest of it. So we're looking at really two kind of main prongs of research. Research into lifestyle, and then really deep, deep, deep into a cellular level, looking at ways of actually rejuvenating cells, whether they be brain cells or even muscle and bone cells.
Well, one difficult thing that many Americans have to cope with as they age is dementia or Alzheimer's, and there's been a lot of Alzheimer's research over the years. What do we know now about whether or not Alzheimer's is preventable and maybe reversible?
Well, actually, this goes exactly with that kind of two-prong approach to the research. There was a small study done last year that had really fascinating results. They put people with dementia, only 10 people total in the study, so a very small study, but they put them on this very rigorous 36-point program. It involved what they ate, when they slept, how they exercised, etc. And they found 9 of the 10 people actually showed improvement in their memory and cognitive impairment. So this is actually suggesting that lifestyle could be a big factor in how you stave off or even improve yourself after, you know, dementia and memory loss is set in. So that's really promising, but very, very small study, so I don't want to oversell it. And on the flip side of the coin, they are looking at new ways of imaging the plaques and tangled proteins that actually we think cause Alzheimer's. And by imaging them, they're going to be able to develop much more targeted therapeutics, much better drugs that can really get at the problem. That's years away. Again, I don't want to oversell it, but it's really promising and exciting research.
Well, it's a huge step because, as I think I read previously, an autopsy was the only way to detect these things, obviously past when it's useful. So now we can actually detect those signs when we're still alive, potentially.
Exactly, exactly. They're developing new techniques to actually, you know, look into the brain as it's firing and start to identify areas that are operating abnormally, areas that are growing abnormally, et cetera. And they're really untangling it all. As you can imagine, the brain is incredibly complex, especially the human brain, but they're making significant inroads into imaging it that will lead, a little further down the road, will lead to much better drugs, much better targeted drugs.
And, of course, people who face aging want to know what they can do to be proactive and be counter whatever it is they may be coming up against. And one of the things we keep hearing about is sort of brain workouts, almost treating your brain like a muscle. What do we know about whether or not those actually work?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I love about the special section is sprinkled through it, there are all these little tidbits that you probably got an email from it or about it or saw it on Facebook, and we're actually looking at the real science associated with these anti-aging claims. And you're right, there's a ton of brain training exercises out there, and the science is actually pretty promising. They showed that people 65 and older who attended 10 one-hour brain training courses, they learned to, you know, solve puzzle, memorize lists, those kinds of mental exercises. They show that 5 to 10 years later, most of the subjects maintained the gains in cognitive function that they exhibited when the courses were complete. So it looks like, you know, it's a pretty light lift to say, hey, instead of watching TV and vegging out for an hour, try a Sudoku puzzle. You know, I think all of us could manage that. And the effects appear to be not only definitive, but long-lasting. 5 to 10 years afterward, they're still, you know, going strong.
And we worry about diet and whether that is linked to dementia. Those of us who say might have eaten two pieces of cake today might wonder, is there a link between sugar and long-term risk? Yeah, there was cake at the office. It happens. So does sugar have a link in the long run to dementia?
You know, the short answer is maybe. The problem with sugar is that it changes the way your body responds to insulin because, generally speaking, the more sugar you eat, the more you put on weight, the more weight you put on, the bigger the fat cells get. So the fat cells start responding differently to insulin. And all of that ties into what we believe are some of the triggers for Alzheimer's. So it looks like there's a link, unfortunately. If you eat a lot of sweets, you might want to start cutting back on them and, you know, going to maybe some delicious unsweetened tea or fruit. But I just want to say on the other side, something I was really excited to read when I saw this story is, you know, there's another healthy aging claim that if you really restrict your calories to a very, very low level, even lower than a lot of people think is healthy, if you restrict your calories, you're going to increase your lifespan. The research on that says, yeah, maybe not, because there's really mixed results when they restricted calories for people. So I'm thinking, you know, don't give up the cake entirely, but just have one reasonable piece instead of the whole cake, you know?
Well, we're talking right now with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak about the latest in cool science news. And we're starting out right now talking about what science has to say about the aging process and where the big advances are happening. And eyesight and hearing, Gemma, a couple of areas where we can see some downhill momentum come a certain age. What do we know about what science has to say about how we can stall that or maybe turn it around?
Well, just if you look, for example, with vision, pretty much everybody, when they hit the 50-year mark, your eye just goes through certain changes. It goes through degeneration. It's just the way it is. But now they're developing all these new techniques and potential therapies. And one of them that's actually already FDA approved, it's called the Argus II Retinal Prosthesis System, which is really cumbersome to say. So even the researchers call it the bionic eye. And they can actually, they can implant it. It's got, I don't want to get too deep into things, but it basically has a tiny little electronics system in there that helps where the part of your eye that weakens with age, it kind of takes over for it and takes the same stimuli that weakened part of your eye would look at and translate it so that your brain can understand it as if that part of your eye was functioning normally and at full strength. And that's just one of, you know, many, many promising therapies and treatments out there.
Well, moving on to another story, ancient footprints evidently are telling us a story about some of our distant, talking a million, couple million years ago, ancestors. What are we learning from footprints?
Yeah, well, you know, all over the world, there are these handful of sites where ancient footprints, either from humans, members of the genus Homo, or even earlier from Australopithecines, who lived, you know, 3-4 million years ago, we do actually have some of their footprints preserved. And the oldest site is 3.6 million years old. It's in northern Tanzania, and they're actually able now to use photogrammetry, which is a three-dimensional way of visualizing the footprint, and using that instead of, you know, the old school casts where they would pour the plaster in and risk damaging the actual footprint. No. It's all digital now, and they can actually tell from the information they get not only how the foot was placed on the ground, but where the weight was distributed, how it lifted off the ground, all these really interesting things. And why is that important? Well, you know, one of the most important and unique things about our genus is that we developed the fully bipedal gait. Now, when did that happen? There's a lot of, you know, well, I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. There's a lot of controversy about when bipedal gait developed. And these really special footprints are helping us understand how it evolved.
And anything that we've gleaned so far about who these people, or at least these human ancestors, may have been and what their lives may have been like?
Not that much, just because, you know, it's so far back. They can tell a little bit how they've walked. That's a big deal because it helps us, again, understand how we evolved to be fully bipedal. But, you know, it's interesting. There are some other footprints that have been found in places like Laetoli in Kenya and even in England, where you can see by the number of footprints and the size of the footprints, you can get an idea whether it was, say, a hunting party or perhaps a family, a mixture of adults and children. And that really kind of, you know, makes them makes them a little, I think, more immediate. One of the folks we interview in the story, he's an ichnologist who looks at these ancient footprints, and he said, you know, you can't look at them without thinking, was this person hunting? Was this person playing? You know, what were they doing when they actually made this mark?
Well, we humans, our ancestors, developed this unique evolutionary trait, walking on two legs. You also wrote a piece, Gemma, about plants with a unique adaptation, eating living stuff, the flesh of animals. Tell us about the carnivorous plants.
Well, this is, you know, this is our October issue, and this is kind of our subtle little tip of the hat to Halloween, which, as you know, is my favorite holiday. And I just started wondering some questions about carnivorous plants. So I started, you know, going down the rabbit hole and digging up more and more research. Carnivorous plants, crazy, okay? There are 600 or more species of them. And we've got everything from the largest carnivorous plant, which is Borneo's Nepenthes raja, that can fit a half gallon of fluid in its pitcher. It's a pitcher plant type.
Wow.
Then there's this other, I mean, one of my favorites, I have to say, the bladderworts. They are the fastest carnivorous plants around, full stop. They couldn't even document how fast they were until they had high-definition video, because they opened this little trap underwater so quickly that the change in pressure just sucks the prey right inside, and then it closes just as quick. They couldn't even see that to document it until just a couple of years ago. So they're absolutely nuts, and they're all over. You've got probably either carnivorous or proto-carnivorous plants in your garden. It's very possible.
And there are plants also that you mentioned that have evolved sort of a fancy sideline to that. They start by luring the insect in to go to the bathroom with insect poop, and then that's how they get their food.
Yeah, it's terribly unglamorous, and I don't know if you want to talk about it on radio. But basically, you know, these famous pitcher plants pretty much evolved to be, if you can imagine it, kind of like toilet bowls. And, you know, the little animals sit on the rim munching on whatever delicious prey is caught up in the tendrils of the pitcher plant. And they do as animals do and, you know, get rid of their business. And that's actually what the plant has evolved to digest. So not tasty at all. I apologize to any listeners who are having like a snack right now, but yeah, they're pretty much their poop eaters.
Well, carnivorous plants, who knew? Gemma, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you. Always fun.
That was Gemma Tarlak, senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the latest science headlines.